Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're going to take you on an Asian adventure. But before we do that, we discussed our visit to Berlin in last week's program, and we wanted to revisit the subject because there was so much that was left unsaid about the goings-on in Berlin. Right off the bat, I think that we should say that it is a city just absolutely chock-a-block full of museums. In fact, I think we hit one or two every single day we were there.
We were kind of busy. We were busy with that, and some of them we liked better than others.
Yes.
So we thought, well, what a good idea it would be to make some recommendations to you that we think will make your experience all the more enjoyable, because you'll make sure you hit the high spots and you'll miss out some of the spots that aren't perhaps quite so high. Actually, last week we really only focused on dining anyway, sweetheart, so we didn't really cover what the Berlin experience is like. It's a really fascinating
Well, to start one, with, right now, I think people should get prepared for the fact that the city seems to be perpetually under construction. And your favorite joke is, tell your joke about the cranes.
Yeah, they have a new kind of tree in Berlin. It's called a crane, and there are almost as many as there are trees dotting the skyline, very tall. And at ground level, there are lots and lots of holes in the ground. So the wonderful street Unter den Linden is fine at one end, but at the other end, it's totally under construction, and you can't see what a beautifully laid out street it is.
And that's that great gate.
The Brandenburg Gate. But anyway, back to art. Shall we do...
Or archaeology. Let's start with the Pergamon
piece,
so
because that's
your most favorite thing, and I found it extremely exciting.
We're starting with oldest first. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's... I mean, it really is fabulous. I had always wanted to go to Turkey to see the Pergamon, which is a major Hellenistic work of art.
You would have been disappointed if you'd gone there.
Yeah,
right?
Because here it is in Berlin. At least part of it is. The massive altar is in the museum, and called the Pergamon Museum. And I don't know if anybody else knows. I mean, I happen to be trained as an art historian, so I do know that the earliest and most significant archaeologists in modern times were, I'm talking about 19th century and 20th century, were Germans. And so they unearthed that. Plus, talk about the other things that you were so absolutely amazed at in that museum.
There were two fabulous things. There was a temple to Augustus and to Hadrian, I think. Right opposite that, the market gate of a town called Miletus, which is also in what used to be called Asia Minor, mainland Turkey. The most amazing thing, the thing that startled me the most, was the brightly colored, lacquered brickwork associated with the triumphal entry road going into the ancient city of Babylon, which was built by King Nebuchadnezzar II, I believe. And I forget how many centuries B.C. it was, but it was a very long time ago. An extraordinarily impressive reconstruction, and lots and lots of similar relics from that region of the world, which was very much the hearth of civilization as we know it today. So that was a truly remarkable experience. Now, somebody somewhere was prepared to spend money going back to a couple of centuries, I think, for the German country of Germany, whether it started before was a country, I'm not sure, to obtain paintings, presumably off the open market, going back to the 13th century level or the 14th century, with Botticelli and Fra Angelico and all those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were even some earlier ones in there.
But going forward to only a modest 17 Rembrandts, and even more wonderful Frans Hals and Anton van Dycks, every period represented. We spent 2.5 hours in this Gemälde gallery.
Gemälde meaning painting.
and we could have spent more time than that.
Yeah.
But let's come more to the present day.
The one that impressed me the most,
this is Anne's favorite.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had never, of course, been in a bunker before, nor had I been in a above ground World War II era bunker that has this long-standing history of moving. It was a some sort of repository facility storing something. Then it was a discotheque. And finally, the Boros family made money off of advertising, I guess money in a big way, because he started collecting contemporary art in the mid-70s, buying from such important venues as Art Basel and the Venice Biennale. And he has 700 works, and he bought this first five stories of the bunker are the art gallery venue, and then I'd love to have seen, but we weren't invited to see, their private quarters and their penthouse above that. That must have been something to see. But this is all cutting-edge artwork, and you need to go online and make your reservations. They conduct small group tours, in either German or English, and each room is astounding. My favorite being, since it's a food show, Peter knows this, I went crazy over the perpetual popcorn room. It's an installation of a popcorn air popping, I believe, popcorn making machine, which just continuously spits out popcorn to the point where it fills the chamber, it spills over onto the floor. Eventually, it's going to fill the entire room. I'm not quite sure I could envision that.
I just realized, sweetheart, the reason that the mound of popcorn wasn't all that large is that when we were there, the exhibition had just replaced all the works of art that had been on display the last 3 years with a whole new lot. So I'm guessing.
And they're going to continue doing that, but you have time to grab this one because it was just absolutely installed. And we sample, you can eat the popcorn, so you can interweave a little dining in here.
No butter, no salt, it wasn't all that good. But there's some truly astounding works there, totally world-class, the kind of art that you wouldn't see. I don't think I've seen a museum collection that's as good as this one anywhere in the world. We've been to lots of them.
It's contemporary, it's conceptual, it's installation, that kind of thing. There are, of course, other museums as well. As I said, you can go to one every day or two every day. But I think that something to note about Berlin is that it's, as my friend Michael Rudenberg, who his wife is Germany-born, and he knows the city well, says, Berlin is not really a beautiful city, and I guess considering its history, you can understand why, but it is an interesting city, and I think you'll find a lot of interest in Berlin.
Well, hold on a second. Just before we go, there's an aspect of the history of Berlin that if you've lived through the last 50 or 60 years, as we have, you realize how much Berlin was a part of the Cold War, was a part of the conflict between East and West, was a divided city and a divided country for such a long time. And it's the biggest reminder of that probably is Checkpoint Charlie, which was the only valid entry point from East Berlin and East Germany into the Western zone. And it's there right on a main street called Friedrichstrasse, which is one of the main streets for shopping. So it's an interesting reminder of how the country of Germany and the political scene in Europe as a whole has changed during our lifetime and during lifetimes even a little bit shorter than that. And one last hint, one last tip, if you like to shop, you can certainly do that here. And the ultimate place to shop is a 7-story department store called KaDeWe, KaDeWe, pronounced V-E. And you can have anything there.
It's sort of like a Harrods with this food court.
Absolutely is.
With designer labels, any designer label you've heard of or not heard of.
And the only oyster bar in Berlin.
Which was delightful. We had a perfect match with the oysters. I think we sampled our first German oyster and matched with a German Chardonnay.
Anyway, here's the deal, listeners. If you're interested in more If you have particular questions about visiting this area, we have a lot more information that we'd be happy to provide. Just send us an email at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'll get right back to you with more helpful information. And now, after a break, we'll resume the theme of today's program, which is Asia and food.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we're going to launch into our discussion of some new cookbooks and new insights into Asian cuisine. Through a variety of books here. The first one actually is, I'm surprised that this is Charlie Fan of San Francisco's Slanted Door first book, because he's made a name for himself and has been an icon for years. But this one is called Vietnamese Cooking at Home. And believe me, if it's as easy to do as he tells us, you're never going to go out to eat again. Here's Charlie.
Well, I was just saying to Charlie Fan, I've been eating in all of his Slanted Door locations, or have eaten in all his Slanted Door locations, and we've known each other over the years at various times. So when I got this review copy of his new book called Vietnamese Home Cooking, I was absolutely startled to find out it was his very first cookbook. Joss, how did you avoid writing a cookbook up until now?
I procrastinate. That's why I didn't graduate from school. Well, I think you really need to. For me, I was always nervous about my cooking, so I felt like I need to have a lot more years of experience before you write anything.
Well, now, how many years of experience do you have? You started cooking as a teenager, right?
I started cooking when I was like 14 years old. I'm 50 this year.
Oh, you're not 50, Charlie.
And the restaurant was opened 17 years ago.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure. I've loved every meal I've ever had there. But this is entitled Home Cooking. Now, isn't that the style of the Vietnamese food that you serve, actually, at Slanted Door?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just home cooking in a restaurant space.
And you mean if I follow these recipes, I'm going to be able to create these meals at home for me?
Yes, you can, as long as you buy the good ingredients. Yes, you can.
Let's talk a little bit about what defines, in your mind, home cooking, Vietnamese home cooking. Why is it different from restaurant or commercial cooking?
Well, obviously, you're not cooking for 400 people. You don't have the time constraint. In restaurant cooking, you have to get the food out pretty fast, and you have multiple serving time. But in general, some restaurant cooking, in fact, some item in the book, it's sort of considered restaurant cooking, like the steam bun. There's just a lot of steps, so You might not have time at home to, but you might do it on a weekend. It takes you 2 days to get the dough and the yeast and so on. But all in all, this whole notion of home cooking is, the idea is you can whip this meal up fairly quickly. There's food that you can probably do in 20 minutes, start to finish. The idea so that you can make dinner, yeah.
Well, one of the things I think is really significant about this book is it's almost a cooking technique lesson in a way, if you know what I mean. You focus on technique.
Yes, I think in order to understand Vietnamese cooking, there's two things you got to. Number one, you have to understand the aesthetic, like what the Vietnamese consider nice and beautiful and tasty, and the way they eat it. So with the photograph and the story to get you understand the Vietnamese aesthetic. And secondly, you have to learn about the basic principle of each technique. If you don't understand those principles, then you're not going to be really good at cooking those recipes, because you wouldn't understand why you would saute the vegetable first instead of the meat first. Mm-hmm. So the book is trying to get you to understand the principle behind each technique, whether or not steam or grill or stir fry. Stir fry gets a little complicated because which one you go first, you know, which one you saute first.
Even making pho, you say the order in which you put the ingredients into the bowl is important.
Well, there's a rhyme and reason why we do it that way. In Japan, they put the broth in first, and they pile the noodle to then put the meat and all the condiments inside. But the Vietnamese do the noodle and the beef first, and they pour the broth up to the beef. The reason is we want the beef to be raw, so we can't really pour the broth if we essentially controlling the water level, the soup level.
Mm-hmm.
So by putting the noodle and the beef sitting on top of the mountain, then you bring the water to the top of the mountain, then you don't overcook the beef. So these are things each culture has its way of doing. The Japanese aesthetic's a little different. They want the broth to be certain level, and they don't mind the noodle. If you had a little less noodle, it's underwater. But in this case, we don't want the beef to be underwater. Or we want the water, the broth, the hot broth, melting the fried shallot for the chicken noodle soup so that it permeates. So you want to pour over it rather than just let it sit on top of it.
Now, you organize this book according to the techniques. And the chapters are things like soup, which is very important, steaming, braising, street food is a little bit separate, but you have frying, and you also have the tools you need to do all this stuff properly, huh?
Right. You can't not talk about Vietnamese street food, so that's the oddball, the odd man's out that throw in there.
Everybody loves it.
That encompasses all the different techniques. People will probably won't buy the book if there's enough street food in there.
Yeah, they do love it, don't they? The other thing I thought was curious is that, well, of course, you do have illustrated photographs step-by-step for doing these techniques, but you did a whole bunch of photography in Vietnam.
I want you to get the scenery. I want you to understand where it's all come from, what it means. In fact, one photograph, you see a couple sitting on the street with big down coat jacket, big sweater. It's cold. So from Ho Chi Minh City up to Hanoi, it takes 2 hours. So it's equivalent going from L.A. to Seattle. So so give you a sense of the place that it's actually not as small as you think. Everybody thinks people in shorts and short sleeve and warm weather running around flip-flop. But on the contrary, if you get up to the north, it's actually cold. They wear boots, they wear jacket, and in the wintertime. And the food up there is a little different. And I really want, my whole everything I do is really about stories, about tradition or a capsule in time. This is how the Vietnamese eats the last 20, 30 years, and what I know the last 40 years at least. And I'm sure it continues to change, but it does have a certain amount of tradition within the last 40, 50 years. The French were there, and they impart some of the food, like the short-lived rib braise or the baguette. These are French food that we interpreted. It become the Vietnamese tradition. I think that not having Vietnam, it wouldn't be as sexy, I guess, or intriguing.
Now, you interweave your personal stories in here, and it's hard to imagine you living in Vietnam with all that pressure on. You said you hardly ever went out.
When you grew up with it, you're kind of used to it. When I was born, the wars already happened, and there's people wandering in the street with guns. And actually, I feel a lot safer than here. At least those people with guns in Vietnam, they only shoot people in the jungle. They don't just randomly shoot people in the middle of the street.
Isn't that the truth?
But there's a lot of kidnapping, and especially parents that with a little bit more money. Yeah, I was always bummed that I couldn't ride my bike on the street or be out in the street. I was probably a little bit more protective just because my dad was a little well-to-do, better than some people. I always resent that. I wish I'm out in the street.
But now your whole family emigrated to actually landed in Chinatown in San Francisco?
Yeah, we left Vietnam. We went to Guam first for
A
year, 2 years, and we ended up in San Francisco, Tenderloin, then moved to Chinatown shortly after that.
Does it seem unreal to you looking back to that? And your kids wouldn't even have a clue about what it was like, huh?
No, but they know how to play the Internet. I didn't know how to play the Internet back then. So
so they can find out.
Yeah, with them, I just want them to understand how hard life could be. And as long as they're a good person, I'm sure they'll never know what it's like to. And then again, I don't know. until when I had my kid, my dad, essentially 46, 47, when he took me out in the middle of the ocean. And imagine you're 46 and you have six kids and you don't have no clue how to feed them, and you're middle of the ocean and you don't have any food and you don't know how to speak the language.
Oh, yeah.
And it just kind of amazed me, until I have my kids, I will know what it's like to be dad, like dad. And he passed away when he was 85, and I was 43, 42 and a half, exactly half his age.
So he had a chance to see you being successful in San Francisco.
Yeah,
that must have been a great delight for him.
Well, he partied like pretty hard at the Ferry Building opening. Like, he never stayed up more than 10 o'clock, but we partied for 4 days, and he's shown up like every single day till midnight. So yeah. I think he was proud, and he always, you know, in the beginning, he wanted me to be an artist, and wanted me to be an engineer and doctor and stuff like that. But he realized he made a merchant kid. You know, he didn't have a doctor kid, and I was not good enough. I was not smart enough or distant enough to do math and English and work in chemistry.
I
always like to work with my hand.
I think you're a pretty smart and disciplined guy myself.
I
think you're understating your achievements. Now, let's before we forget, before we say goodbye to the wonderful cookbook, what's the latest status of your restaurant empire? I think you now have six restaurants?
Yeah, I try not to count them. They're all very individual. We have a new one coming. We're in the food service in the Museum of the Academy of Science. We have Heaven's Dog out the door, Wuhing General Store. Those are Chinese concepts. But we're about to embark on a southern concept with fried chicken and bourbon.
Oh, wow. It's something a little different.
Why that?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the working title is called Bourbon Bar.
Why did you want to do that, Charlie?
Family's sort of grown. We just won the best restaurant bar in the Tao Cocktail. So it's not just me. We have a great group of people that have been with us a long time. We have a catering company. We have a wine director. We're known for our Riesling list. A cocktail. We've been doing artisan cocktails for the last 9-10 years, so we've been recognized by the trade group as being one of the best restaurant bar in the country. In fact, we were competing with even London and Europe. And it's just really exploiting our many talent in the company. And there's a little space next door, and Eric Atkins, our bar director, and I just happen to be addicted to bourbon with my architect, Ole Lundberg. And we saw this way. I said, let's do a bar here. And evidently, people tell me I do a pretty mean fried chicken, that it's Charles' take on fried chicken. And it's just really a way to create this family, to build a business, so hopefully we're going to have some money when we all get old. These guys are, hopefully they'll never leave. We're going to grow old together. We all have kids together now. Kids, he's no longer this young guy. My chef at Slant Door, she's been with me 17 years, 16 and a half years, and she have a 5-year-old daughter. And
she's the one that we met then.
Yeah. So it doesn't like... A lot of these people is not going anywhere, so I got to figure out how to make them a lot of money.
See, you've got to
Sure. Now, am I right that one of your restaurants is now back in the Mission Street building where it all started out? So the circle's sort of a little bit closing, huh?
Yeah, the original side, we got moved out and up by in the building. We put in, it's called the Wuhing General Store, after my father's general store.
And next, the bar with the fried chicken is going to be right next to that?
No, next to the Fair Building. The Bourbon Bar is going to be next to Fair Building down by the water. It's going to have oyster and fried chicken.
Oh, great. Now, great. So it's not going to be in the Ferry Building, but it's going to be close by.
Yeah, it's half a pier over. It's at Pier 1.5. And really, our company is really about doing the right thing, buying the right food, sustainable, and research to tradition and history and cooking. And what are the Southern Creole gumbo... So we just go to work, and we're going to try to make the best gumbo. We're going to try to serve the best French 75.
Well, you know, I'm looking at this recipe in the cookbook for turmeric and beer-battered soft-shell crab. Now, that's not traditional Vietnamese.
Oh, they fry everything. So, yes, they have soft-shell crab, and and I try to exploit the wonderful soft-shell crab of East Coast. And, no, it's yes, they do.
You know,
they do fry it, and... You can see the dipping sauce. It's all the way we eat is a little different. We don't just eat the crab. We got a lot of lettuce and mint and wrap it. The frying thing is just a way to help the food go down.
Uh-huh. Glossary is something we should know, too, because if people are timid about launching into cooking Vietnamese food, not only do you talk about techniques, not only do you tell them how to deal with the equipment, what they need and how to take care of it, you also, your glossary isn't just a standard glossary. You have photographs of every single product that you're describing. And that really makes it, I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen a picture of a BAM shoot at this stage of its life.
I think just don't worry about cooking it. Just learn how to enjoy the book. See that maybe it turned into a coffee table. Just for food, imagery, and get you excited. You know, maybe you don't cook tomorrow, but maybe you go to a Vietnamese restaurant. And you learn how to eat first. I always believe that you should learn how to eat something first before you learn how to cook it. If you have it in your head, and where are you going, like that perfect golf shot or that basketball throw, then you could start feeling and mimicking. If you don't have it in your head, it's very hard because you're just going to go, it's like cooking in the dark. So
well, this,
you
I
might
think
burn
is
yourself.
Really goodness. I get, it has me fired up, Charlie, although I really would rather come to your restaurant.
Oh, you can do that too.
well, we're overdue to come to California, so we'll be in touch. We were at the Santa Door last time because the only person who could get us a table at the Santa Door the day we wanted to come was you.
Oh,
so we thought that was pretty okay. And in going through the book, I realized that the one ingredient that we didn't know very much about, but which we now do because we got some samples of a wonderful fish sauce called Red Boat, which you probably know. So having Red Boat on hand is enough to inspire us to begin, and so we'll be sure to try it.
Yes,
good
it's
with
not
your
sick,
book.
So you should try it.
Yeah, Charlie, good luck with your book. Again, it's called
Thank
Vietnamese
you.
Home Cooking. Good luck with your other new restaurants and your ongoing projects, and hopefully we'll see each other soon.
I just have one question for you, Charles.
Yes.
Have you tried a bourbon called Pappy Van Winkle?
I know it quite well.
You know
I love
know
it myself.
Well. You probably have your own barrel.
We actually had Van Winkle in our well for the last 10 years. Get our own barrel. We don't do that anymore because they've gotten so popular. But.
Well, once again, Charlie, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and I hope we'll have the opportunity to meet you soon.
Thank you, folks.
And don't go away because we've got another fascinating interview right after the break. Okay, love.
Welcome back. Next up is a truly amazing book and beautiful, just gorgeous to look at, called Japanese Farm Food. And the author is rather singular, I would say. Her name is Nancy Singleton Hachisu, and she's just brilliant. And you're going to find the whole concept of this kind of cooking and also the perspective that Nancy, who is American-born, California-born to be exact, brings to it. She's married to a Japanese guy. Well, she's going to tell you her whole story. So let's listen to Nancy Singleton Hachisu.
When I first picked up this book called Japanese Farm Food, written by Nancy Singleton Hachisu, right?
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful book, and I'm thinking...
Thank you.
She's living this charmed, fantastic life that I am so envious of. I can't stand it.
I'm not sure how charmed it is. But thank you for saying so, Anne.
Oh, yes. But then as I read further, I thought, oh, my God, I couldn't do this for a million years. I mean, just give our listeners an idea of all that you do. You run the school.
So I live on an organic farm in Japan, and my husband's a farmer. He actually has a free-range egg farm, and then he grows most of what we eat, rice, wheat, vegetables. We also buy from friends. We have three homeschooled sons, one of whom is in college in Oregon. The other two have recently entered Japanese school, much to my dismay. And then I have a little immersion preschool / after school program. And I teach cooking periodically and involved in slow food when I have time. And I write as much as I can. But It sounds busier than I am. Basically, well, I just sit at my computer.
I mean, sounds,
wherever I am, yeah.
It sounds certainly busier than I could ever imagine. I mean, and you also, you left out, you make all your own pickles.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And plant rice.
And my husband grows our rice, yeah. And I brought 52 kilos with me when I came to the States for my various signings, dinners, and bookstore signings. Serve some little rice balls to people. And different chefs at different restaurants are using the rice in the dinners.
Is
and I brought my homemade
rice?
Miso. Well, it's special that my husband grew it.
Okay.
And that, for us, is very special. It's one of the common varieties of Shitomi Bore. It's grown organically, and our friends helped plant it. We have a bunch of slow food friends from Tokyo come out, and also local people come out and help do the rice planting by hand. And then we have a big party afterwards, sort of lunch and dinner in the day. Friends come out, and some of the mountain people come and do this fertility dance called Shishimai, just to help the rice grow and to help the planters get some good energy to keep on going. It's really hard work, actually.
Of course it is. The book is filled with hard work. I mean, it really is. I mean, I know about farming, and it's hard work anyhow. But did we mention that you're in a totally, oh, of course, you've lived there now for, what, 15 years?
No, 24 years.
24, okay.
Yeah.
So you are a native Californian.
Yes.
I imagine this was a little bit of a transition, but your husband sounds adorable.
Yeah, we had both. He had spent about a year in Brazil as a student, and I had spent a year in Belgium as a high school student, an exchange student. So, and I'd spent time in Mexico. You know, I had experience in foreign countries, and he had experience in Western countries, and he's a very global, outlooking guy, but he's also extremely traditional Japanese, and he came from a long-standing farming family. And we thought very carefully before we embarked upon this marriage. But yeah. I think that any couple has transitional problems. But we were able to make a life, we made a little bubble around us. And so we made our life work by the two of us. And that probably is one reason why we homeschooled. Parents did live one street away. We built our own house, and we eventually moved into their house. We renovated their house and moved in. And
I thought it sounded as though you had blended cultures pretty efficiently, except for the fact that I think it's still dominated by Japanese, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
Yeah, I can't say which part. It's definitely, we live in Japan, and we live in the country, so yeah, it's Japanese life. But the thing is that farming all over the world is declining, except the United States is having a rebirth, which is lovely and very inspiring. But we were able to, because we're a mixed couple, we were able to remake the farming life work for us in a way that 100% Japanese couple wouldn't have been able to, because you get so much pressure to do things the right way.
Uh-huh.
So we were able to be a farming family and in a sort of new way, and that made it possible for us to continue having a farming life, whereas this is a very difficult idea for most young Japanese, because there's a lot of traditions you have to pass on, and you have to take care of the parents-in-law, and you have to, you know, really knuckle under and be the parents, be the dominant people, and it's a hard life. And I for one could not be the take a sideline and just be, you know, say yes.
Yeah, well, you wrote that somebody you mentioned said yes, a lot, and then
my mother-in-law, yeah, and the poor woman, you know, she married into this family with her husband was a very strong man, and he had a very strong mother and five very strong sisters, and she married into this family, and the poor woman, I mean, just really, she spent her life saying hi,
yes,
which
yes,
is yes, and then she gets a daughter-in-law like me that she can't like push her thumb onto it. It was, I really felt sorry for that situation, but I couldn't change it. I was who I was, and I knew that if I just pretended to be somebody I wasn't, then I would just be swallowed up, and it wouldn't be good for anybody.
Well,
so
now, in a quite unusual way, this book, what's it called? Japanese
farm food.
Japanese farm food. It's
right.
A variety. It can be read at a variety of different levels. First of all, it's a fascinating story of the life you just described just a little bit for us.
Mm-hmm.
But then woven into that is a lot of information about food and a lot of information about how to cook it.
Uh-huh, yes, because that's how we sort of the interweaving thread throughout our life, and has always been in my life.
And that's why you wrote the book. What was your mission in writing the book?
Well, it was because sexually it was really my husband's. It's our family food, and my husband's a very, very good cook, and so I took a backseat to Japanese cooking to let him do it. You know, we had three kids, and I didn't want to be a wannabe Japanese. I wanted him to take that role, and I did the other kind of cooking. And then I never saw a cookbook that had his feeling for the food, this sort of direct, not sweet, very bold kind of tasting simple food. And I always wanted to put those recipes, you know, into a book. And also our friend has the soba shop, his food too. It's different style, but same thing. You could really taste him in the food. But as I wrote the recipes and the food became mine, because that's how it works when you're cooking. There's only, the recipe is not static. So essentially there are no written recipes of our family food. I just anecdotal. And so yes. Tell me, and then I'd make it, and it would slightly skewed to my taste, but it would taste similar, but maybe slightly skewed. And some of the things are just completely my food, like the zucchini coins. They're just raw zucchini.
Oh, those are yours. I wondered. They sounded, didn't sound exactly.
Well, they're completely Japanese in idea, but yeah. We do grow zucchini now. People are eating it, but flavor, but it's not something, it's not a known Japanese dish by any means, or the salads. Japanese are going to usually just like squirt some mayonnaise on and there's your salad. Or by and large, bottled dressings are what people use, but it's sort of a ridiculous idea to get jarred bottled dressings.
Well, the same story about the iced tea, bottled iced tea is so popular.
Yeah.
I mean, that was absolutely amazed me when I discovered that. I can't remember the name of that company that capitalized on it, on the market.
Right.
Who knew there was a market, a Japanese market for iced tea bottled?
Oh, yeah.
As I'm looking through this book, now, the recipes you said are blended between your take on it. There's some other element that I wanted to mention is, I didn't know you before, but some of what you write has this tinge of spirituality. I don't know if that's something you gained there or if you already had it when you went.
I don't know. I think it's probably something that perhaps did evolve when I was there, because just also with age, reflect back, because I think in your teens and your 20s, you're just really living for the day and living for what's happening in front of you. And then as you get older, you reflect back and you... So in Japan, I realized I was by default a Christian. I was never brought up a Christian. My parents were atheists. But I realized, well, actually, I grew up in a Christian culture. And so that was interesting for me. So I'm not really strictly practicing, but I also do believe that, I mean, I grew up in sort of a wild Irish-American family, lots of yelling, lots of fighting, and and so it was very calming to me, for me to be in Japan, truly.
Yeah,
and
I grew up in one of those, but they were Sicilian,
right.
Louder than the Irish.
Yeah. Right, and that was how I knew how to communicate. But and also doing the school has been extremely fascinating, how you grow up the kids, because you don't just have like, so I had my three kids I brought up, but then I have all these other little kids, and so you really, really learn a lot from that process. And you can really see, because you're stepping outside and you can see the family influence, you can see like the kids that sock their father at home in a play game, they're going to sock their friends at school. You know, that's how they think of communicating. It's like when I grew up in a fighting family. I think that's how you're supposed to fight with, people when you're talking to them. But so it's just, now my husband loves to fight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you've changed him in return.
I know. Yeah, I've created a monster gut, right.
Well, you have all the instructions you need, the kinds of utensils, the different products, explanations of products and so forth, and very clear instructions in terms of each recipe. But I think we said, or did you say, that you really wanted to inspire people to kind of do their own thing with your recipes?
Well, within reason, I tried to present it so that very, very simply so that people could understand that you can substitute other vegetables and get the idea of what it is. Somebody wants to put sugar in it, I don't care. Go ahead and put sugar in it. I don't particularly like the taste, and we don't use it so much. It's not our taste. If you want it saltier...
You do have a dessert section. I'm not a dessert person, so I haven't really
A lot of Japanese people put, after the war, the use of sugar increased. So traditionally, Japanese food was not sweet. But then after the war, with all the shortages, using sugar was a great it was a sign of wealth, and it was a sign of being kind to your guests to something super, like a salad-y, I mean a vegetable treatment or a, something with soy sauce, like a simmered thing, then the sugar use was sort of special. And so, but farmers didn't necessarily use it every day and for their food.
Well, what do you... This is a stupid question, but I mean, like, where are you now? I don't mean Chez Panisse. I mean, where are you in your head and in your life?
I'm not sure. I'm thinking a lot about the book, and I'm thinking about the next book, thinking a lot about community. I've been involved in a soy sauce making group that's a bunch of young families in their 30s or so sort of organized this group, and my friend is mentoring the group and growing soybeans for them, and it's like a co-op community of we share the work to create the soy sauce together. I think that's really exciting. I'm feeling really hopeful about the situation of small farmers in Japan and getting people to come back to the land. Still worried about the artisans, small door makers and people like that. You need a long time to apprentice for that kind of stuff, but kind of worrying.
So you said book two is already in the pipeline or at least been thought about? Book two?
Book two, yes, right. Yes, book two is about it's still sort of under, but it'll be talking a lot about community and about community-driven projects. And
well, Nancy,
that's what
I mean,
I can say.
I wish we had longer to talk. I mean, I wish you were around like a long period of time so we could talk, because I think you and I would be best friends.
Right.
So. So, and meanwhile, I wish you the most success with
your
book tour and also with the book itself and then with the book tour, too.
And, Thank you.
I wish I could taste some of the rice balls.
Right.
I want to taste some of those eggs.
Which eggs?
Right, I'll bring them next time, right?
The organic eggs.
Her husband's
They're
eggs.
They're very good, yeah.
Yeah, the egg recipe is a big section.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't realize that eggs were so big in Japanese cuisine. But
oh, definitely, yeah.
Well, you made them that way, didn't you? Perhaps you were trying to help your husband's business along.
No. It's a way of life there, eggs on a daily basis.
Well, it's a lovely book.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that I will be cooking from it exactly, but I would like to eat the food in it.
Okay. Well, just look for the simple things.
That's what I'll do. Nancy, so nice to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Peter.
And,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'll let you know if I make something and it's a success.
Okay, great.
Okay, Nancy. Ciao.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, ciao.
Bye.
Bye.
And don't go away because there's another interesting segment right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we're back. And again, it's not just interesting, it's what I think is another revelation. Who knew there was a Chinese cuisine called Hakka? Well, there is, and the author, Linda Lau Anusasanan, I got that, is going to tell us all about it. I said I've been around food culture forever and ever and ever. I've, on both sides of the table, I've traveled. I studied art history before that, and I have never heard of Hakka. Food or culture or cuisine. And here we have now the Hakka Cookbook, written by Linda Lau Anusasanan. Got it?
Very good.
Welcome. Explain exactly, first of all, what is Hakka and why have we not heard of it?
Well, basically, the Hakka were the nomads of China. They originally... And this, I have to tell you that there's many stories about the origin of the Hakka, but this is the story that most of the Hakka believe in, that they originally were located in north central part of China. Around the 14th century, invaders swept in and they started a very long migration. And as a result, the Hakka had no land for centuries, and that was quite unique to most of people from China. Most people in China had a home, but Hakka were landless for centuries, and they developed certain type of spirit and were able to certain ability to survive because they were always kind of being the unwelcome newcomers. They, you know, they came in, the land was all taken, so they had to, you know, work off the crummy pieces of land. And they became very good at surviving. They were very independent and strong and sort of like pioneers, but also not well-liked by the local people. So they moved to the south and eventually all around the world.
They kept getting pushed out of places?
Yeah, because they were the last people to arrive. And it's like, you know, you're the newcomer, you're a new kid on the block. People don't like you. And also, by the time they arrived, all the good pieces of land were taken. So they had to settle for usually in the mountains or inland, usually less desirable pieces of land. And often they were not, they didn't live in a connected area, but they were sort of dispersed in little small plots of land. Well-liked or, you know, they worked hard, so people kind of resented that because they were being successful.
What began then this idea that they would leave China and go to other parts of the world? I mean, that's fairly radical.
Well, it's kind of part of the history of China. Like in the mid-1800s, there was a lot of turmoil in China. There was civil war. And then there was a huge rebellion in China called the Taiping Rebellion. And it was led by a Hakka man who happened to believe he was the brother of Jesus. And what he was advocating, he wanted to improve the life of the oppressed. And a lot of the oppressed people were Hakka. He also wanted equality for people and especially for women. He was an advocate of women's equal rights. Also, he wanted to make the welfare of the people better. So he had very democratic ideals. And he wanted to get rid of the foreign rulers and the Manchus. So it led to this huge civil war where over 20 million died. But unfortunately, they lost. So a lot of the Hakka people were not very popular, and it wasn't quite a bit of danger. So many of them left to seek safety and a better life. And, you know, also at this time, a lot of other Chinese were leaving, too, because there was a lot of famine, there was civil war coming, so a lot of people were leaving the country at this time.
Now, you were born in California. We haven't even mentioned that this book is called The Hakka Cookbook, subtitled Chinese Soul Food from Around the World. This was a huge project for you to undertake. You were a food writer, but you were curious to uncover your roots.
So that's right.
Explain what this project was, how you traveled and found out these recipes and all the information. Book, I might say that it's so packed full of information that, and also excellent recipes, absolutely packed with history and information, cultural information. What a project. How long did it take?
Took me a long time. I probably started thinking about this book in 2002.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't probably really start working on it on a really full-time basis until I left Sunset Magazine in 2005.
Okay, and then you started traveling. You went to back to China and started from there, working your way into all the through all the diaspora of the Hakka people.
Yeah, I have to say I didn't go to every single place that the Hakka lived, but I had done some research, you know, reading research and stuff on the internet, and I had read that the Hakka had settled in. They were concentrated in certain communities throughout the world. So my plan was to visit a number of these places and then find out what they ate. And so some of the places I wanted to go to was obviously China, which is, you know, where it all started.
Yeah, you have a map that shows where it is believed that the Hakka originated.
Right. Yeah. I went to, there's a region that the Hakka now sort of call the Hakka Heartland. And this is located in, like, the northeast part of Guangdong Province, which is in southern China. And it goes over a little bit into Fujian Province, which is neighboring, and a little bit over Jiang. But anyway, this area was where I actually found my father's home.
Oh, my.
And I didn't actually expect to find it. I have one uncle who's still living, and he was able to give us the Chinese characters for the village that they grew up in. And I had asked the tour guide if, you know, would we be able to find it. He said, well, I can't find it now, but I think if we get close, we should be able to. And I was amazed. All he did was show this. We got to the general area, and then he would show the Chinese character to local people, especially older people. And then I guess someone recognized, and before I knew it, we were there.
Amazing. Now, we're talking about food. You probably don't have, or do you have, a general characterization of the Hakka cuisine? I mean, wasn't it modified according to where they ended up?
I think I asked this question of a lot of people, and I got a lot of different answers. But this is what I heard a lot, sort of like the comfort food of the working man. It's very robust, satisfying, straightforward. It uses a lot of soy sauce, cured and preserved vegetables, cured meats.
Because they traveled. I mean, it was
because they traveled and they were in isolated areas. Food could be fatty and salty because they were hard workers, and a lot of them were in the fields. They needed kind of food to sustain them. And that is sort of a country cousin or a branch of Cantonese cuisine, which also makes sense because they lived with the Cantonese as neighbors for a long time. So I think there was a lot of sharing between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, too, as I traveled, I think it has become much more diverse than that. This is, I think, the roots of the cuisine. These are very true of the roots of the cuisine. But as I traveled, I saw that there was a lot of influence from the different regions. If it went to Sichuan, it would pick up a little bit of chili.
Yeah, how about in Peru? I mean, you certainly would have a different Hakka cuisine in Peru, wouldn't you?
In some ways, this is the other element that surprised me. In some ways, yes, you would have the other elements that would come in, but then you would also have things that tasted so traditional that they reminded me of dishes I ate in China. Both ways, they would hold on to their traditional roots, but then they would sometimes take in the local ingredients would be maybe different. Maybe the fish is different.
Uh-huh. Potatoes you'd have to have in the...
Yeah, they would have... Sometimes they would make substitutions with the local ingredients. The local tastes are a little bit different. In Peru, they have a... Chinese food is really popular. They have restaurants. They call them chifas, which are, I think it means like... sort of like the Chinese words for eat rice.
Uh-huh.
And Peruvians love Chinese food.
Yeah,
now, the food that they serve Peruvians is a little bit different than what the Chinese actually eat, because I think for the Peruvians, they maybe sweeten it up a little bit, and the ingredients are a little...
How does your grandmother fit into this?
Oh, well, my grandmother is probably the reason I wrote the book. When I was a little girl, she lived with us, and she would tell us, you should be proud, you're Hakka. Well, frankly, my brother and I, we didn't really care because we didn't really want to learn how to become more Chinese. We were already the oddballs in school. But she insisted that we should learn to be good Hakka children. So after school every day, we would have our Chinese class, which we would have in her kitchen.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Her name was Popo.
Well, Popo is the word for Chinese word for grandmother.
Oh, okay.
So we called her Popo. And She would teach us how to write Chinese words with, you know, ink and brush.
Oh,
and we would read Chinese picture books.
Now, the art is very elegant in this cookbook, too. It is by Alan Lau.
Who is my brother.
That's what I figured. Very nice. Is he an artist full-time?
He is a professional artist, and he also is a poet. A poem about Paul that he wrote many years ago. And he also has, you know, sort of a day job that supports himself.
Bitter melon and tomato sauce?
That recipe came from someone I met in Toronto, Canada. And she told me that she had a secret to making bitter melon not so bitter. And I don't know if you've ever eaten bitter melon before.
Well, yeah, I have, but I've only in a Chinese restaurant and only in soup, whereas they had it in my local farmer's market this past year, and I wanted to buy it, but I didn't know what to do with it, so now I have a recipe.
Confess, I'm not a huge bitter melon fan myself, but it's very popular, and Hakka really like it a lot, and that stuffed bitter melon is a very kind of typical Hakka dish.
Okay.
And what this particular woman did, Marie, she's from Trinidad, but she lives in Toronto. She would stuff the bitter melon, you hollow it out, and you stuff it with pork, and then you brown it, and then kind of braise it, and then she would add tomato to the sauce. And she felt that the tomato gave it a slight sweetness that would mellow the bitterness.
Uh-huh.
And it does to a small extent, but it still comes out quite bitter.
And the other classic Hakka, I guess it is.
They like mustard greens a lot.
Yeah, tell us about the mustard greens.
Oh, yeah, mustard greens are in a lot of recipes, and they're used in different ways. And there's so many different types of mustard greens. It's used in soup. It's often preserved in some form. Sometimes it might be salted. It could be pickled. It could be salted and dried. And there are many variations. I have a recipe in there for a really easy kind of mustard green, a pickled mustard green that I like. And it's made with a type of mustard green that looks like a heart almost. It has extremely wide stems, and they like to pickle that part.
Oh, my.
And you can find that sometimes in the Asian markets. But you can also buy it in a market already prepared. Although the fresh ones are better, but you can, you know, buy it already made up, and it figures in a lot of dishes. There's some dishes where they just cut it up and they stir fry it with a little piece of meat, or they slice it and they put it in soup, or they just eat it with like rice soup as a condiment.
Well, Linda, there's so much in this book that people are just going to have to buy it and read it, and work through it a bit at a time. And I must say thank you for introducing us to something totally new in the culinary world, because I had never heard of it, and now I have something further to explore.
Well, I hope you enjoy it, and you can see where the Hakka had lived all over the world. I mean, you'll find recipes there where people came from Jamaica and India and South America and Hawaii and Peru. So I think people will have fun with it.
Well, I think so, too. And thank you for talking to us.
And that's all for today's On the Menu radio program. We hope we'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.